Hello and welcome to our programme. My name is Angus McVicar and I will be reading Time Magazine here on Sight Into Sound Radio. Our first article this week is titled Five Things Therapists Do When They Feel Lonely, written by Angela Haupt. Join an easy group class. When Courtney Morgan, a therapist in Louisville, Kentucky, wants to be around like-minded people without having to try too hard, she goes to a yoga class. Sometimes I want to feel connected without actively engaging in a conversation, she says. She tells her clients to seek out structured programming they're interested in too, whether it's fitness-related, educational, or something artsy. During your class, aim to appear approachable, she suggests. Resist the urge to look at your phone. Make eye contact with people. Smile. Ask a stranger if you can sit next to them. And thank the instructor. All are small ways to feel better connected. True friendships can take years to develop, which isn't exactly comforting to the 1 in 3 US adults who say they are lonely right now. But you don't need to wait for a new best friend forever to feel better. Small acts can help give you immediate relief from loneliness, experts say. We asked therapists what low-effort steps they take in their own lives when isolation starts to creep in. Send a voice text. Audrey Schoen, a marriage and family therapist in Granite Bay, California, loves communicating via voice message. When she meets someone new and exchanges contact info, she sends them an audio message instead of firing off a text. And when she feels lonely, she reaches out to friends in the same way, or replays old voice messages that she saved. I love receiving voice messages and I love sending them, she says. They feel so much more personal and are an especially fun way to keep in touch with friends who live far away. Cuddle a pet. Research shows that spending just 10 minutes interacting with cats and dogs reduces the level of the stress hormone cortisol. So it's no wonder Alison Gubel, a therapist in Morristown, New Jersey, seeks out her pups when she craves company. I find it hard to feel lonely in the presence of animals, she says. There's love there, and there's loyalty there. Plus, pets open the door to social opportunities. She once advised a lonesome client to take her poodles to a local park and position herself in a way that was really open, not scrolling on her phone. It worked. People made small talk with her and asked to pet her dog, which lifted her spirits. Dogs are an invitation, she says. Go people watching. When Samantha Bender, a social worker in El Paso, Texas, feels lonely, she heads to a local coffee shop where she can people watch while sipping on a saffron latte and reading the latest Stephen King novel. Sometimes loneliness isn't about our direct relationships, she says, but how we feel in relation to the world around us. There's so much going on in public spaces, new sounds, scents and sights, that it grounds her in the present moment and distracts her from tinges of loneliness. You can soak it all in and feel like you're part of something without having to extend a lot of effort, she says. We don't always have the mental energy and capacity to connect with others one-on-one. And finally, flip through old photos. It's so easy to forget fun, fulfilling times when you're all alone. But looking at photos of favorite memories can help. It immediately sparks joy, says San Francisco therapist Erica Bent, who does this whenever she feels isolated. Thinking of beautiful moments helps me remember that I'm worthy of connection. It also helps reignite the possibility of feeling less alone, she says, which is sometimes the most powerful antidote to loneliness. End of article. In world news, our next article is titled A New Age of Naval Warfare, written by Alessio Patilano. With the sinking of the Sergei Kotov in early March, a whopping one-third of Russia's Black Sea Fleet has been disabled. The maritime theatre of the war in Ukraine remains the most significant since the Falklands, but it is also part of a larger story about naval power, which has come back as a central feature of struggles from the Black Sea to the Red Sea, South China Sea and Taiwan Strait. This is not just about the strategic value of capital ships to project a nation's international standing and ambitions in an anarchical international system. Naval power matters today more than ever before because of how modern society's relationship with the sea has evolved. Today we live in a maritime century. one in which the very foundations of the prosperity that underwrites open economies rest upon maritime physical and digital connectivity. Sea lions feed us, keep us warm, and deliver the furniture of daily life. Some 97% of the internet and a major portion of international energy use relies on an undersea spaghetti bowl of cables and pipelines that closely mirror commercial shipping routes. This multi-layered network of physical and digital connectivity is safe and reliable only until it is not. In recent years, places as diverse as Somalia, Tonga, the UK, and Taiwan have experienced economic losses because of disruptions to critical undersea infrastructure. By the beginning of this year, the relatively sophisticated capabilities of Yemen's Houthis exposed just how vulnerable the steady supply of basic commodities, from tea bags to the average household in Britain, to core components of electric cars across Europe can be. This unprecedented reliance on maritime connectivity has made activities at sea a primary target of authoritarian regimes and non-state groups. Actions such as the sabotage of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the gas pipeline linking Estonia, Finland and Sweden, and the disruption to international shipping caused by Houthi missiles and drones share one thing. These actions highlight the realization that maritime connectivity is a pressure point with a significant political value, and that pressure can be applied by state or non-state actors. Countries like China in particular are pursuing the naval means to seize the opportunities emerging from such a realization. Whether in the field of technologies for deep seabed exploration and exploitation, shipping capacity, or above all in the context of sheer naval might, China is setting new records, both quantity and quality of its investments. In the past decade alone, China has added over twice the number of ships to its surface fleet as what the entire French Navy commands. Chinese authorities understand that in the maritime century, their ongoing naval build-up is a down payment for maritime superiority, if not supremacy, in a potential major war in the China Seas, the Taiwan Strait, or beyond. Xi Jinping's appointment of Hu Zhongming, an operational experienced submariner at the helm of the Navy, confirms that a new generation of flag officers is entrusted to deliver readiness if ever needed. This is why navies matter, and why the US and allies in Europe and Asia are actively debating how to invest in them. Leaders in countries like Japan and Australia are investing in their navies, from counter-strike to surface, carrier and submarine projection capabilities, so that they can collectively meet the growing authoritarian challenge at sea. That includes Japan's unveiling in December 2023, the largest defence budget in its post-war history, and Australia, which is already procuring nuclear-powered submarines through AUKUS, announcing last month plans to double its surface fleet. However, others like the US and Britain are finding it harder to meet growing naval demands. In the US, the Navy will ask for only one Virginia-class submarine for the next fiscal year budget instead of two, because of the limits of industrial capacity. In Britain, a recent parliamentary report noted how plans to introduce several new classes of ships need more shipyards first. In a contested maritime century, we should start thinking about navies as the ultimate national security insurance policy. Like any insurance, they demand regular investments against risks that are unlikely but potentially grave. Navies work best to deter would-be aggression, but the industrial base to generate their capabilities underwrites military credibility. Crucially, when all else fails, that credibility stands to make certain that in the hour of need, the hardest challenges will be met and overcome. End of article. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Pakistan's generals fail to fix an election. Pakistan's worst-kept secret is that its military dominates its government. Whether to safeguard the nation against chaos or to protect their own privileged access to power and wealth, its generals have manipulated the country's politics for decades. Pakistan's voters, like voters elsewhere, want change. February's ugly election fiasco shows that it's only getting harder for the army to prevent political disruptors from upending their plans. But unfortunately for Pakistan's future, they have yet again managed to override public demand for a new direction. A brief recap. The generals and popular leader Imran Khan decided some time ago they could no longer trust one another. The army then removed Khan from his post as prime minister and put him in jail, as it has done to many past prime ministers who refused to respect their dominance. He now faces more than 150 criminal charges, all of which he denies. When the brass refused to let him contest February's national elections, even from prison, aides in Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf PTI party created AI-generated Khan speeches that were then broadcast around Pakistan. In a nation where 40% of voters are illiterate, army-dominated courts ruled that ballots could not include the symbol of Khan's party, a cricket bat to reference Khan's professional sporting prowess. But the party vowed to press ahead. When the generals refused to allow PTI members to appear on ballots, many ran as independents. Both the army and a former prime minister, the exiled, then rehabilitated Nawaz Sharif, were confident that destroying Khan's candidacy would assure a victory for Sharif. It did not. Even after manipulating courts and the media, stuffing ballot boxes, and turning off mobile phone service and social media in areas where Khan voters were setting their get-out-the-vote plans, the nation's self-appointed overlords could not stop voters from shocking Pakistan and the world by handing victory to the independents who stood for Imran Khan's PTI. They didn't win a majority, but they did win more seats than any single party. It took the army and its political subordinates 3 weeks to untangle this mess and find a way to keep Khan's party out of power. On March 4th, Pakistan's newly formed parliament announced that Shahbaz Sharif, Nawaz's brother and the interim prime minister since the army grabbed power again last August, will again lead a coalition government, all in the name of stability. It's reasonable to wonder why Sharif or anyone else would want the job. Pakistan ranks 161st out of 191 countries in the UN's Human Development Index. Its economic prospects remain poor. About 40% of Pakistan's people live in poverty, and inflation stands at about 30%. Power outages are a fact of daily life. To pay its foreign debt to avoid default, Pakistan's government must come up with more than $20 billion. Its current reserves have dwindled to less than $10 billion. The country is increasingly isolated. China and Saudi Arabia, traditional investors in Pakistan, increasingly see the country as a bad commercial bet. Traditional security partners in the US are less interested, particularly since the US withdrawal from neighboring Afghanistan. And though Khan has vowed that PTI lawmakers will sit in opposition, the party's followers have already demonstrated an ability and willingness to generate major trouble in the streets of Pakistan's largest cities. Worse still, the army establishment has shown Pakistan voters that their country's democracy cannot create the change they need. That bodes ill for the nation and all who would lead it, whether they are elected or not. End of article. The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. To liberals, Mitch McConnell is a master of the political dark arts, willing to do anything to serve his conservative aims. He enabled multiple GOP White Houses to play the long game. The Kentucky Republican puppet mastered into reality a regulatory regime that allows unchecked corporate and secretive individual cashback into politics, picking the scabs of what remained in campaign finance law until there was nothing left. In the liberal worldview, not only did McConnell steal a Supreme Court seat from Democrats in 2016 and clear the way for the conservative bench that dealt the death blow to federal abortion rights, he also stacked the decks in lower courts. And when the opportunity arose to finally purge the Republican Party of Donald Trump for good with a history-making second impeachment trial, McConnell looked the other way. Well, those same liberals who professed nothing short of loathing for McConnell might be about to find how much worse things can get without the Senate chieftain keeping his Republican caucus in order. McConnell on February 28th announced that he was putting an end to his record-setting 17 years atop the Senate Republicans' hierarchy. Only one other incumbent Republican, 90-year-old Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, has experienced Washington before McConnell began pulling major levers of power. and just 7 incumbent Republicans have served in a Senate where McConnell was not in the party's top job. That longevity did little to mask McConnell's evident disappointment in his own news. "Believe me, I know the politics within my party at this particular moment in time," McConnell said in the well of the Senate. "I have many faults. Misunderstanding politics is not one of them." As much as Democrats like to demonize McConnell, he has been a responsible cog for must-pass legislation to keep the government open and the national credit card working. McConnell helped President Joe Biden pass part of his infrastructure investment agenda, and during the Trump years provided a reliable guard against some of Trump's most bananas ideas. But absent McConnell's Senate know-how, the chamber could soon devolve into its own version of the chaotic cosplay on display over in the House. While Democrats have no love for McConnell's approach to politics, they often took it for granted when he rallied his ranks when it mattered. Perhaps the shrewdest mind in politics neither side of the aisle right now, McConnell is cognizant that he's leading a party that disagrees with him in major questions, or at least hews to Trump's prescriptions out of fealty or fear. McConnell has fought an increasingly lonely fight within his party to secure funding to help Ukraine battle against Russia, much to the dismay of Trump and his perspective that views NATO as a racket. A $95 billion aid package for Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan cleared the Senate on February 13th with McConnell's blessing and vote, and is stuck in park over in the House. For McConnell, who arrived in office thanks to the same 1984 ballots that saw Ronald Reagan win 49 states, a Cold War footing has evolved but never evaporated, and Moscow's aggression needs to be answered on the battlefield and done so decisively. That put McConnell on a collision course with the Trumpists in his party. But since securing the party's top role in 2007, McConnell has taken the criticism in stride. The self-described Grim Reaper of the Senate knows the rules well enough to thwart any legislation or nominee he found objectionable. "I'm a proud guardian of gridlock," he said in 1994. With an often inscrutable smirk, McConnell watches the chessboard of Washington and is seldom surprised. After all, the tactician has run every model 20 clicks downstream. But McConnell, who judges success in the Senate just as clinically as he does when watching his beloved University of Louisville Cardinals teams, knows the score. In recent months, the 82-year-old minority leader has faced health challenges after alarming freezing episodes. Congress's doctor released a terse statement clearing him to serve, but the whispers never really stopped. Even as McConnell delivered Trump legislative wins and confirmed his judges, the then president continued insulting the team player. While McConnell employed his mastery at advancing Trump's agenda or blocking Democrats' efforts where he deemed it necessary, he did so without any measure of appreciation from the president, who was focused on the few areas where McConnell refused to go his way. "McConnell plans to remain in the Senate. I still have enough gas in my tank to thoroughly disappoint my critics, and I intend to do so with all the enthusiasm to which they have become accustomed," he told the Senate, where his aides lined the walls to watch the boss start unspooling a remarkable run. The Kentucky Republican's legacy will be studied for generations, much of it trained in his obsessive partisan focus. But as leader, he was a voracious student of history and precedent. And most important for Democrats, McConnell has never shielded his point of view or his priorities. That predictability helped the Senate stand as a guard against House-caliber chaos. At best, it will be a learning curve for McConnell's successor. At worst, the Senate may lose its traditional check. It would be, as McConnell himself observed in 2013, a landmark. No majority leader wants written on his tombstone that he presided over the end of the Senate. Washington cannot afford that norm to be the one that falls next. End of article. CO2 Leadership Brief, written by Justin Warland, senior correspondent. Spend enough time in climate circles, and you'll almost certainly hear about the need to evolve international institutions to make them fit for purpose. The World Bank needs to galvanize more investment in climate solutions. The UN needs to bring countries to a joint solution to address global warming. Success has so far been pretty middling. One exception is the International Energy Agency, IEA. Last month, the agency, which was founded amid the oil crisis of the 1970s, held a celebration in recognition of its 50th anniversary. And there's a lot to show for it, especially in recent years. The agency swiftly pulled together a plan for Europe to avoid blackouts and political chaos after Russia cut its gas supply to the continent. And the agency has shifted the zeitgeist on the energy transition, showing governments and businesses potential decarbonisation pathways using data and research. At the heart of the agency's success has been its charismatic executive director, Fatih Birol. When Birol took over the IEA in 2015, the agency had a reputation as a close friend of the oil and gas industry, and not so much as an agent of decarbonisation. But Birol put climate at the centre of the agenda. He sought to bring emerging economies into the IEA's fold and redoubled its expertise in clean energy. Governments need to give very clear political signals, he told me in 2020, explaining his focus on clean energy. The IEA crafted a report in 2021 to show how the world could get to net zero. The data around different energy sources became a go-to for companies and governments looking for signals about how the global economy might wean itself off fossil fuels. I don't think there's an organisation right now that's as impactful at helping all of us transition into clean energy, David Turk, the US Deputy Secretary of Energy, who previously worked at the agency, told me. Some in the oil and gas industry have taken issue with the numbers, complaining that they're too optimistic. Another key change has been Birol's focus on quickly publishing usable research in response to world events. The IEA's 10-point plan for Europe to survive Russian gas cuts, published in March 2022, came together just weeks after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, for example. Europe has not only made it through one winter, but through two, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said on February 14th in Paris at an event commemorating the agency's founding. First and foremost, thanks to you, Faith Birol. The IEA's transformation is also significant to the private sector. For energy industry players and financiers, its numbers provide bankable data to drive investments. But the agency's work is worth following, even for businesses only tangentially related to energy, for a simple reason. It shows how fast things are changing. End of article. In news on the economy, our next article is titled No Recession, Thank Women, written by Joanne Lipman. Remote work allowed Alison Velasquez to juggle her demanding roles as a Wells Fargo talent recruiter and as a mother of two young children, including a son with special needs. The flexibility made sense both for her job, working with hiring managers across the country, and for her kids, ensuring she would be available for medical appointments and pickups. Remote work is wonderful for working mums, she says. Women like Velasquez have flooded into the full-time workplace over the past few years, spurred by flexible options combined with the rollback of pandemic-era school and daycare restrictions. The percentage of prime-age working women, defined as ages 25 years old to 54, set a record in 2023, with mums of very young children leading the way. These women have become the economy's secret weapon, and one of the reasons why the recession that just about everyone predicted hasn't happened. Despite almost two straight years of dire forecasts, unemployment remains low, consumer spending has held steady, and productivity is on the rise. On February 20th, the Conference Board, which had been warning of a recession since July 2022, finally abandoned its call. The strong labour force participation of women workers and the strength of the economy are intertwined, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told me in a recent email exchange. She attributes the employment gains for women in part to the child tax credit and other initiatives, but also important is the increased flexibility of the workplace that came as a result of the pandemic, she said. That flexibility has been key for women like Laura Podesta, who left her role as a CBS television correspondent in 2022, when her sons were 3 and 1. Her long hours in the studio, along with frequent travel, made me start to reassess what I was committing to, she says. She pivoted to a hybrid position, overseeing communications for Fiverr, a freelance platform. I decided to make the move in large part so I could work from home part of the week, she says. Flexibility helps corporate bottom lines too, because employees are less likely to quit, recent research suggests. Replacing just one employee can cost twice as much as their salary, after factoring in recruiting and training costs, according to Gallup. Valerie Dana, a Seattle mother of five who spent years as a communications and human resources executive at companies including Starbucks, today works part-time coaching other women who are transitioning in their careers. Some want to switch companies, and some are looking to start their own, she says. But they all want hybrid. By providing flexibility, she says, companies retain the talent longer, which saves the company money. Yet now the progress is being threatened by a wave of return-to-office mandates. High-profile companies, including Disney and Meta, are requiring 3 or more days a week in the office. Bank of America threatened employees who don't comply with disciplinary action. IBM told remote workers they must move to be near a company office or quit. United Parcel Service says that as of this month, all employees must work on premises 5 days a week. And a global survey of CEOs found that almost two-thirds expect a full return to office by 2026. About 40% of employees work remotely at least 1 day a week, according to Stanford University economist Nick Bloom, a figure that has remained steady since December 2022. But fully remote opportunities are drying up, and researchers have found that those workers are more likely to be laid off than peers who spend time in premises. As a long-time manager of teams, I empathize with the importance of in-person work for collaboration, mentoring and culture. But at a time when women, finally, have made a historic employment gains and are contributing to the economy's resilience in the process, why put policies in place that will instead chase them away? Inflexible mandates are already squeezing out women who want to stay in the full-time workforce. Livia Fine, a litigator who worked at a major Manhattan law firm, moved during the pandemic to a town outside the city to raise her 2 children. She believes she can be just as effective remotely, but mainstream law firms don't agree, and she's yet to find a comparable position. In her Hudson Valley town, she says, she's surrounded by women in similar situations. These are some of the most vibrant, intelligent, community-oriented, brilliant women I've met, she says. What a waste for companies not to hire them, she adds. You're creating a society that's pushing us out. A global Gallup poll found that the majority of women who want to work included a majority of women not currently in the workforce. They boost the economy in multiple ways. Research by the National Partnership for Women and Families estimated that leveling up U.S. women's participation would add $650 billion to GDP. A 2022 Moody's analysis calculated that increasing U.S. female labor participation could add $1 trillion to the economy over the next decade. Women's economic contributions are outsized, providing a little extra oomph because they tend to be more educated and more productive, says Claudia Sam, a former Federal Reserve economist and founder of Sam Consulting. And the surge in female workers has already helped tame inflation, says Boston College economist Alicia Munnell. Without it, the labor markets would be even tighter than they were otherwise, which would have led to wage increases, making inflation harder to control. Adding workers of any gender lifts the economy, and labor force participation among prime-age workers overall is strong, reaching 83.3% in January, topping pre-pandemic levels. But a big driver of this is likely the ability to work from home, particularly for women and for workers with a disability, who have seen some of the largest rises in working rates, says Stanford's Bloom. Indeed, employment rates for the disabled and other groups that need flexibility have also reached new heights. That's why it's so confounding that companies are rushing to dismantle flexible options. JP Morgan Chase is among the firms that have called back senior executives 5 days a week, and other employees 3. Chicago-based Abby Schmeling, a VP of content strategy and mother of 2, was able to get permission to work remotely. If you can't trust someone to work remotely, you made a bad hire, she says. I do better work from home, and I'm certainly working more hours without a commute. But she is still an outlier. Certainly there are multiple other factors beyond women's employment driving the economy's resilience. Paul Grunewald, Global Chief Economist at S&P Global Ratings, credits significant productivity gains. A Nobel Prize-winning economist, Claudia Golden, told me that interconnected strands of data about female employment and economic strength can be hard to pull apart. If women's employment increases and we see the economy doing well, what caused what? This isn't a question I would like to answer on the fly, although it does seem like the entire economy is the dog and the women's employment is the tail. Either way, let's not erase women from the conversation about the economy. By not acknowledging their contributions, companies will continue to take actions that often squeeze women out. That includes Velasquez herself. The Grover Beach, California mum says she was laid off from her six-figure Wells Fargo job after the bank called her back 3 days a week to an office 3 hours away. She and her husband have since put on hold their plans to buy a house and have considered cost-cutting options like selling a car or pulling their three-year-old out of preschool. Return-to-office mandates are pushing us out of the market. People like myself, Velasquez says. A lot of the mums I worked with that are still unemployed are in the same boat. What do we do now? End of article. We have come to the halfway point of our program. You're listening to Time Magazine on Sight Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight Into Sound channel on HD4 or 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. Our next article is titled, Why We Overspend. The rise of frictionless payments make it easy to keep buying, whether we can afford to or not. Written by Alana Samuels. My credit card is a mangled thing. Its blue plastic backing is peeling, so much that it doesn't work in swipe machines. It looks like a dog chewed it up and spat it out. It seldom leaves my wallet anymore, but that doesn't matter. In the 2 weeks before writing this story, I spent more than $4,000 on my card without laying eyes on it. Each of these transactions was made online, where my card number is stored. That's probably why I didn't flinch when I spent $333 on groceries for a weekend with friends, $48 on a pizza through Uber Eats, or even $1,500 for an Airbnb when my extended family came to visit. Without having to type in my credit card number, the purchase seemed less significant. Frictionless transactions are common in today's economy. You can wave your cell near a cash register, press buy on Amazon without really knowing which credit card you're charging, and send money to a stranger via your phone without having met them in person. There's even a company marketing a ring you can use to pay for things. These technologies, often referred to as fintech for financial technology, make spending easier than ever before. And there's growing evidence that they're making us shell out more than we realize. With so many different accounts to keep track of and so many merchants debiting what we owe every month, we just keep on buying, whether we can afford to or not. US consumers spent a record $19 trillion in January 2024, up 4% from a year prior and 29% from January 2020. Spending has soared, despite inflation, high interest rates, and repeated commentary from economists that this ebullience can continue, and yet it has. There are reasons why people are spending so much right now. Consumers saved a lot of money when they were stuck at home during the pandemic, and now they're making up for lost time by traveling, eating out, and doing all the things they couldn't do during quarantine. The government helped people feel flush by sending out stimulus checks and pausing student loan payments. After years of slow wage increases, workers' payments are finally growing more quickly than prices, giving them extra pocket money. But there's one additional factor that has changed since the beginning of the pandemic. People are more accustomed to using financial technology to pay for things, which eliminates barriers that might once have slowed their spending. Convenience makes it much easier to enjoy the process of shopping, removing the additional difficulties of buying things, says Sharon Lee, a professor at the University of North Carolina's Keenan Flagler College, who has studied frictionless payment methods. Research shows that the more frictionless the payment method, the more money people spend. By 2023, according to McKinsey survey, 73% of consumers had paid for something through a browser on their phone or computer, up from 46% in 2019. People are also more comfortable using mobile payment apps like Apple Pay, Google Pay, PayPal, and Venmo. More than 53% of Americans surveyed by Forbes Advisor last year said they used digital wallets more often than traditional payment methods. Paying with a mobile phone is faster than using a credit card. It takes an average of 29 seconds versus 40, according to Zhu. That speed and convenience accelerates spending. Zhu and her colleagues found in a study that tracked spending after the Chinese launch of Alipay, a mobile payment service. The study found that the amount spent in credit card transactions increased by 9.4% and frequency of transactions by 10.7%. It's not so much a matter of loosening purse strings as doing away with them altogether. Once consumers started using mobile payments, they become more comfortable with making credit card payments on their computers and started moving more money digitally. And once they were comfortable spending money digitally, they started spending more money overall. Elizabeth Mendoza, a 33-year-old who lives in Washington State, says she was getting her debt under control before the pandemic by setting aside cash twice a month for various budget categories like groceries, gas, or pet care. She found that she spent less using cash because she would think twice about parting with a large bill. But once COVID-19 hit, Mendoza got into the habit of buying things online and saving her credit card information in different apps. Soon she found herself back in about $20,000 worth of debt. Once I stopped using my cash, she says, I stopped paying attention to what I was doing. Last October, Mendoza vowed to get out of debt and removed her credit card from any app that would save it, including Apple Pay. She now stashes her cash in colourful envelopes every month to make the process more fun. Buying stuff online is more of a hassle now, since she has to go find her wallet and type in her information. But she says it's made a huge difference in her spending. It's just so easy to fall into using your credit card and not keep track of what's going on, she says. Economists refer to the way people organise and spend their money as mental accounting. Humans are often irrational with the way they choose to spend and save money, splurging with a $100 bill found in the sidewalk, while fastidiously saving every penny of their salary, for instance, or spending more money on the same item if they're paying via credit card than if using cash. Mental accounting is a big reason people spend more with frictionless payments. Consumers think of new apps like Buy Now, Pay Later or Apple Pay as a separate budget category that enables new spending, says Michael Gelman, a finance professor at the University of Delaware. In an experiment, Gelman tracked the behavior of consumers who had received a random credit card in the mail. While those consumers' spending behavior on their old credit cards remained the same, they started to splurge on their new one, dropping 26% more than people who had not received a new card. Once you open a new budget category, you manage it separately, she says. It can have an effect on total consumption. You consume more because you have the opportunity. Yanabel Colon, a 35-year-old account manager in the Bronx, was once the type of person who would buy things with cash and use her credit cards for emergencies. But cooped up at home during the pandemic, she started putting more things in her credit card and using Buy Now, Pay Later services. She mentally categorized Buy Now, Pay Later spending as cash, which got her into trouble. I was like, well, it's not a credit card. I don't have payments, she says. Now she sets a budget every month for certain categories like food and makes sure she doesn't exceed them, no matter how she's paying. Strong consumer spending has helped stimulate the economy and provided healthy profits for companies that depend on the American consumer. Walmart saw online sales grow 17% in the last quarter and made about $1.2 million per minute in 2023. Amazon recently reported its highest operating profit in history. But many American consumers are spending beyond their means. Household debt reached a record $17.5 trillion in the fourth quarter of 2023, surging $3.4 trillion since the end of 2019, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Credit card debt has passed a milestone, says Michelle Ranieri, Vice President and Head of U.S. Research and Consulting at TransUnion. Card balances now stand at $1 trillion, 13% higher than a year ago. The percentage of credit card balances that are 90 days or more delinquent ticked up in the last quarter of 2023, according to the New York Fed, reaching nearly 10%. Credit counselors say that the rise in debt is related to the difficulty many face in keeping track of their spending. The proliferation of fintech like Apple Pay and Buy Now, Pay Later creates this scattered universe of different payment options that can lead to overspending and financial instability, says Bruce McClary, Senior Vice President at the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, NFCC, the largest non-profit financial counseling organization in the US. It's especially hard to track all this spending because many of the apps that help people to do so have disappeared in recent years. Mint, the personal finance app, will be shutting down on March 23rd, according to Intuit, the company that owns it. There aren't many good free options left, but there are a few ways that credit counselors say people can combat overspending on frictionless transactions. Jessica Spangler, a money educator whose book, Invest Like a Girl, comes out March 26th, tells people to set up their phones so that they get a notification every time they make a purchase, no matter what payment method they use. That way, Spangler says, you're not just swiping into the void. The NFCC's McClary recommends having only a few accounts where you spend money so that you can track them. It's easy, he says, to set up new accounts and forget that they charge your credit card, which makes it harder to calculate whether you're overspending. As for me, I've started putting reminders on my calendar to check my credit card balances so that I can track how my spending on apps is piling up. Not that it's easy. Digital payments are swift, but the process of logging into my account to track them is a headache. That involves remembering bank passwords and logins, and then waiting for the bank to send me a code to verify my identity. If spending money were as hard as tracking it, we might not do so much of it. End of article. Mind Over Money, written by Salser Burga. Money is one of the most significant stressors for Americans, according to a 2023 American Psychological Association survey of more than 3,000 people. Before moving to start budgeting or making a financial plan, experts tell Time magazine that people should rethink their own relationship with money by mulling their parents' finances, how adults around them modeled spending, and whether they personally overspend or underspend. The hard part is it's not something that's really tied to your personality, says Jack Heinzelman, a certified financial planner. It's really how you grew up and how you were educated in money. In order to best assess areas to improve, financial therapist Tracy Williams advises people to recognize their triggers and note their reaction. What are the things that money is providing that speak to you as a person that can help you to get some indicators, she says. For some people that might look like, I am looking for security, or I am bored, or I do not feel a sense of high self-esteem. And so money provides that for me. She suggests replacing the dopamine rush of shopping with pleasures like baking with your kid, going for a walk, or listening to music. Those who worry about money despite being financially stable may need to work on neutralizing what it means to spend money. There is no such thing as the right or wrong way to do things. They're just the choices that we make. Everyone's financial plan should accommodate their own desires, needs and lifestyle, says Heinzelman. For some, it can be as simple as checking their credit cards app and looking at the amount they spend in categories like food bills or subscriptions. For others, it might be better to physically highlight a bank statement or write out purchases to adequately visualize their spending. The goal is to eventually be able to instinctively set aside a certain amount of money and know that it cannot be touched. Automating the process can help give you control, says Heinzelman. Knowing when to reach out for support is also important. Finances are one of the leading causes of stress, yet only 52% of US adults say they feel comfortable discussing it. But experts say it's better to discuss financial goals, plans and stress with a spouse, friend or family member or others to get different perspectives and also to share your anxieties. Financial advisors can help clients who need someone to make them accountable for their financial decisions. Financial therapists, meanwhile, work at the intersection between a client's finances and their mental health. If your worries are affecting your ability to work on your relationships with your family members or your friends or your ability to take care of yourself, those are usually indicators that you need extra help, says Williams. That help can look different for different people depending on what your situation is and what your need is. End of article. How to Have a Low Spend Month, written by Simone Shah. A popular budgeting trend on TikTok encourages participants to spend a month paying only for essentials while strictly limiting discretionary spending. Here's how to get started. Number 1. Set your intentions. Identify your reasons and goals to help you stay on track. 2. Be mindful about purchases. Take a hard look at your monthly budget, even if it scares you, says Sarah Paulson, a financial planner with Valkyrie Finance. She suggests starting off by cutting back in one category you overspend on, like making coffee at home or refraining from food delivery orders. 3. Don't be too restrictive. Cutting back too much in a low-spend month might result in overspending once the challenge is over. Be honest with yourself about where you might be overspending, without completely depriving yourself of joy. If you look forward to your monthly facial or treat yourself with a takeout on a Friday night, factor those in. 4. Repurpose your savings. If you find that you can spend $100 less in a certain category, the next month take that $100 you were spending in that category and immediately save it somewhere, says Jack Heinzelman, a financial planner at Boston Wealth. Also, automate savings going into a retirement or savings fund or toward debt repayments. 5. Join a community. Ask a partner, family member or friend to join you in the challenge to help you stay on track and keep you accountable. End of article. Still under the heading of finance, our next article is titled Letting Go of My Debt Shame, written by Jamie Feldman. I'm generally not ashamed to talk about personal matters. In fact, I'm known for oversharing. At parties, I'm always good for a few cringy anecdotes plucked from my lackluster dating life. As a writer, I've never shied away from sharing the vulnerable, sometimes ugly side of my evolving relationship with self-worth. Even my earliest report cards mention my garrulous nature. Jamie Feldman talks too much. But there's one topic that I've kept quiet for as long as I could remember, money, or in recent years, the lack of it. I've maintained a fluctuating level of credit card debt for over a decade. At its highest, it hovered around $18,000. From that first moment in my hopeful early 20s, when I felt the shiny piece of plastic in my hands, I was hooked. Now this, I thought, was freedom. I recklessly opened card after card, blatantly ignoring interest rates, skating by on minimum payments, and maintaining a hefty balance at all times. Growing up, there wasn't a whole lot of talk about money in my house. There was just a general sense there was never really enough of it. As a result, I have, for the majority of my adult life, maintained a pretty precarious balancing act of living both in a scarcity mindset and way beyond my means. I've gone through periods of unflinchingly forking my credit card over at $100 per person group dinners, then spent the following weeks living off of ramen noodles and tinned fish. I've thrown caution to the wind and booked trips because I deserve it, then spent hours spiraling at the sight of my bank account. If I wasn't too afraid to even check my bank account, that is. I also naively assumed I was the only one with this kind of debt. The only explanation I could fathom for this mindset was deep insecurities and internalized shame. The facade started to show its cracks in 2021, when smack in the middle of the pandemic I lost my job. A job that I had held for over 7 years and was the only thing keeping me afloat in the sea of my spending habits. Suddenly, the debt was something I needed to face, now. First, I confided in a close friend, which admittedly was terrifying. I was convinced that she'd see me differently, or feel as though I'd tricked her into thinking I was a good person all of these years, when actually I had this deep, dark secret the whole time. What actually happened was this. She simply said, okay, marched me straight into her office, pulled up a chair in her favourite budgeting software, Tiller, and sat there with me at her desk for hours, teaching me how to use it and exactly how to make a budget. Most importantly, she taught me how to stop avoiding the problem. She showed me that my trouble with finances was not, and is not, indicative of who I am as a person. It was invaluable. Once I opened the door to the secret, I realized it was up to me to make sure it stayed open. Telling one person provided me with a huge sense of relief. I wasn't alone. But then came the hard part, holding myself accountable. I needed to do something that nothing would remain in the shadows of my denial. Telling the entire internet might sound extreme, but I knew I'd be less inclined to give up if there were some stakes involved. So I opened a TikTok account and started talking. In one breathless post, I shared the full story of my debt with the entire internet. There was a sense of anonymity that gave me confidence that this was just a mental exercise. Of course, it was not anonymous at all. Suddenly, people started liking my videos. I went from a couple hundred followers to 20,000 within a few weeks. I realized I hadn't really thought this out. What would all these people think of me? But what came next was far scarier. Friends, acquaintances, and family members started to follow me. What was I thinking? Not only was I worried about embarrassing myself, I was worrying about embarrassing them. What would my mum think? My aunt? My nana? What would all our family friends think? I braced for judgment. Turns out I was bracing for nothing. Not only did the thousands of strangers reach out with kind words, so did my friends and family. My mum sent supportive, emoji-filled cheers. My friends encouraged me to keep going, invited me over for dinner, and indulged my new budget-friendly suggestions when we made plans. But what was perhaps more surprising was that everyone had their own money story to share. My DMs were flooded with people telling me their debt stories, and my comments were full of cheers of recognition and solidarity. In some cases, I was the first person they'd ever spoken to about it. Breaking my silence helped them break theirs, and together we realized that talking about it was the only way to escape the deep shame that underlies that silence, and the only way to pave a different path forward. I'm not a personal finance expert, and I don't pretend to be. In fact, I find most experts get it wrong. Most of them tell you to change your behavior but don't acknowledge the deep-seated reasons why that behavior started in the first place. They also often rely on their own shame tactics to change your behavior. You don't work hard enough. You're stupid for getting yourself into this situation. You should feel like you're suffering while you pay debt down so you don't get yourself into it again. This is only doubling down on the root cause. My goal instead is to continue telling my story and to help people get comfortable with the fact that getting out of debt is a group sport, not a solo mission. My life looks a lot different now than it did 3 years ago. My social calendar is smaller. I move slowly and with intention. I track my spending, and for the first time in my life I have a budget. And I have a community of people to share that with, who see me, debt and all, and refuse to believe my financial issues have anything to do with my goodness or humanity. I've rejected all of my prior judgments of being in debt, toward both myself and others. Shame is not an effective tool for change, but connection certainly is. End of article. We have come to the end of our program. I've been reading Time Magazine. My name is Angus McVicar, and this has been a production of Sight Into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas, since 1967.